Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Ratepayers raged at the Helix Water Board in a contentious meeting over a five-year rate hike this week. We'll have the outcome on today's show. We also have news about a disturbing new study that warns many San Diegans are at risk of severe flooding due to extreme rains from El Nino conditions forecast for this winter. Longtime San Diego Sheriff Bill Collender has died, and we'll have reactions from local law enforcement leaders. From Sacramento, we'll have details on bills vetoed by Governor Brown that would have regulated drones, as well as information on a bill signed by the governor to stop gender-based wage discrimination. A monument to the Cedar Fire, the worst firestorm in California history, is set to be dedicated in Lakeside October 24th, and we'll have information on that ceremony for you. From the County News Service, hear about a dangerous new mosquito that's been found in our region and what diseases it can carry. We'll also have information for you on the first Democratic presidential debate coming up next week. Then on Destination East County, hear about some colorful events coming up, from an international jousting competition to a deep pit barbecue and a brand new fall festival, plus much, much more. On the second half of today's show, our newsmaker interview is with Wendy Patrick, a lawyer and ethics instructor, who will be talking about the new Right to Die bill signed into law by Governor Jerry Brown. Bald tires are being blamed for a crash in Ramona involving a van carrying senior citizens. We'll have details for you today. We also have news about a new law requiring defibrillators in many new buildings and about maps that let you look up the fire risk in your community, as well as some helpful resources. We'll have all these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. Emotions got nearly out of control at a packed Helix Water District meeting on October 7th as customers lashed out at the board's plan to raise rates over the next 5 years. After more than 3 hours of presentations from Water District staff and testimony from angry customers, the five-member elected board voted 3-2 to adopt the five-year rate increase plan beginning November 1st and continuing to 2020. Rates could go up as much as 75% for some high-water users. While district staffers assured customers that those rate caps can be adjusted down and that they would have a chance to weigh in on any proposed increase in the future, all of the 36 speakers opposed the five-year plan. Things got heated about an hour into the meeting. As the district's hired consultant began his presentation, several people shouted out that they had heard enough of the district's reasons behind the rate increase. "We're not here for pie charts and graphs. We want to be heard," yelled Peter DeLuca. Others shouted similar statements, prompting one man at the front to yell back, "I just moved here and I want to hear it." More than 200 people attended the meeting, with many lining up on both sides of the small room and more in the hallway outside. Several hundred ratepayers also sent in letters protesting the rate increase. Helix General Manager Carlos Lugo tried to quell the outburst, but it took several minutes before a financial consultant could continue his presentation. Although Helix Water already adopted a two-year rate increase plan in 2013, the district said a five-year plan would give both the agency and customers a clear idea of what to expect going forward. Having rate caps in place would avoid excess rate spikes should the drought worsen and let customers better budget for the future, said Helix staffer Jennifer Bryant. Helix received a total of 557 protests to its plan, but that fell far short of the minimum 23,000 that were needed to reject the district's plan. Many speakers said that they were outraged by the plan, which made no sense in light of their conservation efforts, which resulted in Helix reaching a 28% decline in water use from July to September. Bob Sederdahl said, "No one here walks on water, but you say you can see into the future and predict what the rates will be." He and others criticized the district's high operating expenses, particularly salaries and benefits of its 150 employees. Cindy Dennis said she cut her water use 56%, using buckets while showering to water her yard, but her bill keeps climbing. She compared Helix's water rates to the rates paid in Lakeside, which, according to one graph, are the lowest in the county. She noted that Helix is selling water to Lakeside as well as other water districts. Several speakers opposed the district's tiered pricing schedule, saying it was unfair, and they wanted the agency to adopt a flat rate for everyone, regardless of how much water they use. Robert Capita, who railed at what he viewed as price gouging, said, "I get the feeling that we're dealing with the mafia here." Several speakers charged the district was not doing enough to cut its expenses, especially when it comes to labor costs. You're irresponsible to give your employees the same kind of pensions the city of San Diego does, said Bob Annette. No one in America should be able to retire when they are 50 years old. District staff counter that as a nonprofit, it cannot charge more for the water than it costs, and the increases were caused mainly by a severe reduction in customers' water use and increases imposed by the San Diego County Water Authority, which provides 95% of the district's water. The County Water Authority, in turn, is raising the price on its water because of recent hikes by the Metropolitan Water Authority in Los Angeles, which controls the water allocation and pricing for all of Southern California. The County Water Authority has been investing a lot of money into system upgrades in recent years as well, including a $1 billion desalination plant in Carlsbad. But these and other explanations about the rationale for the increases were not received well by the ratepayers in the audience. DeLuca said there's an underlying agenda here. It's about salary increases and raises for your employees. Board member Joel Scalziti initially motioned to adopt the 2-year plan for rate increases instead of 5, and that was supported by Kathleen Hedberg, but that was voted down by the board majority 3-2. Subsequently, Deanna Verbecki put the recommended 5-year plan on the table, which passed by the same 3-2 vote, with directors Hedberg and Scalziti voting against the 5-year plan. On a Mount Helix Community Forum the next morning, emotions ran high over the vote, with many calling for the ouster of directors who voted for the rate hike at the next election. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
A new report by the National University System Institute for Policy Research, NUSIPR, has some grave warnings for San Diego County. The report states that roughly 55,000 residents and 5,000 businesses could be located in what they call 100-year flood zones. These areas could see flooding during the upcoming El Niño, which is forecast to be extremely severe. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, El Niño is a period of unusually warm ocean temperatures in the Pacific Ocean near the equator, which can cause severe weather around the globe, including droughts, floods, and fires in various regions. Locally, El Niño typically produces extreme amounts of moisture that can cause flooding, especially along riverbeds. The NUSIPR report could be a stark wake-up call, ironically in the midst of a severe drought, that San Diegans should prepare for some serious flooding. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Ed Barrena.
Former San Diego County Sheriff Bill Colander passed away of Alzheimer's disease on Tuesday. He was 80 years old. Colander served as chief of police from 1976 to 1988. In 1988, he retired and took a job as an assistant publisher at the San Diego Union-Tribune. In 1995, he came back to law enforcement and served as sheriff of San Diego County. He will be re-elected 3 times. Colander had been fighting Alzheimer's since retiring officially in 2009. Colander was a native of Chicago and a graduate of San Diego State. He became one of the youngest sergeants in San Diego Police Department history at age 26. Colander's mission in his early years as chief was to get rid of sexism and racism within the department. In the early 80s, he founded the department's service dog program. Nothing is known of funeral arrangements, but the family has asked that donations be sent to the Alzheimer's Association at 6632 Convoy Street in San Diego. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Liz Alpert.
Governor Jerry Brown has vetoed 3 bills that would have banned the public from flying drones over wildfires, schools, and prisons, imposing criminal penalties for violators as well. The devastating North Fire mushroomed out of control, leaping across Interstate 15 in San Bernardino County earlier this year after several drones interfered with firefighting aircraft, forcing one of them to land to avoid collisions. The fire burned numerous vehicles on the freeway and swiftly spread to do widespread damage. On the East Coast, prison officials intercepted a drone that was attempting to drop contraband over a prison ground. Some education advocates have also sought to protect privacy and safety of students from drones flying overhead. In his veto statement, the governor objected to creating a new crime at a time when jail and prison populations are overflowing. Brown indicated that there are already laws on the books that can address the problems raised by these bills. But Senator Ted Gaines, who authored the measure to criminalize flying drones near firefighting planes at the request of CAL FIRE, voiced disappointment in the veto. On Twitter, he concluded, "Our laws must keep up with growing drone tech, or else all of our safety is at risk." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, This is Miriam Raftery.
A new era is happening for working women in California. On Tuesday, Governor Jerry Brown signed legislation into effect that would give women more tools to help fight gender-related wage inequality. The bill was proposed by Santa Barbara Democrat Hannah Beth Jackson and expands the existing equal pay law by asking employers to prove that if a man's salary is higher than a woman's at the same job, it is due to reasons other than gender. The reasoning for higher pay for men must be based on seniority, quality or quantity of work, a merit system, or any other, quote, bona fide factor other than sex, end quote. State Senator Joel Anderson, a Republican representing East County, spoke in favor of the bill on the legislative floor.
There's a gender gap within our own house. And I think that as we're looking out there and we're setting these bars for all the private sector, that we look to ourselves and to our own staffs and to the people that work for us to ensure that every woman gets her fair share. That if she works hard, she shows up and does her job, she's worth every penny a man fulfilling that job makes.
The bill also protects employees from discrimination and retaliation if they ask about how much other people make. However, employers are not required to disclose this information. The bill also states that employees can sue if they feel that they are being paid less than someone who does substantially similar work. The new law becomes effective on New Year's Day 2016. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Liz Alper. A new era is happening for working women in California. On Tuesday, Governor Jerry Brown signed legislation into effect that would give women more tools to help fight gender-related wage inequality. The bill was proposed by Santa Barbara Democrat Hannah Beth Jackson and expands the existing equal pay law by asking employers to prove that if a man's salary is higher than a woman's at the same job, it is due to reasons other than gender. The reasoning for higher pay for men must be based on seniority, quality or quantity of work, a merit system, or any other, quote, bona fide factor other than sex, end quote. State Senator Joel Anderson, a Republican representing East County, spoke in favor of the bill on the legislative floor.
There's a gender gap within our own house. And I think that as we're looking out there and we're setting these bars for all the private sector, that we look to ourselves and to our own staffs and to the people that work for us to ensure that every woman gets her fair share. That if she works hard, she shows up and does her job, she's worth every penny a man fulfilling that job makes.
The bill also protects employees from discrimination and retaliation if they ask about how much other people make. However, employers are not required to disclose this information. The bill also states that employees can sue if they feel that they are being paid less than someone who does substantially similar work. The new law becomes effective on New Year's Day 2016. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Liz Alper.
Chris Conlon is no stranger to mosquitoes.
In this case, it looks to be like there's about maybe 50 to 75 in this particular trap.
As San Diego County's supervising vector ecologist, Conlon spends hours looking at them under microscopes, identifying both adult mosquitoes and the larval stage of the bug that come in from all corners of the county. But there's one species in his lab today that, besides a brief appearance in 2001, had steered clear of California.
It was the result of a citizen complaint. They called us up, said, hey, we're getting bitten by mosquitoes. So we went out to investigate. We put a trap out, and then we also caught a couple of mosquitoes flying around their offices. And when they were brought back to the lab for identification, we discovered that they were Asian tiger mosquito.
Already in states like Florida, Georgia, and Texas, this finding may sound familiar since a relative of hers made the news last year.
We have two new invasive species of mosquitoes that we're looking at, with the Asian tiger being one of those, and that's the most recent find. But late last year, we had also found yellow fever mosquito, and the two mosquitoes share very similar habits about being indoor biters during broad daylight. So we initially were thinking, oh, it's probably one of these yellow fever mosquitoes that we might find there. And unfortunately, it turned out to be this other species, Asian tiger mosquito.
The question that Conlon's office is trying to answer is whether or not this is a localized case, or like the yellow fever mosquito before it, the beginning of an established population in the region.
We don't know yet whether it's only at that one place where it was found or whether it's gone beyond that place. So we'll set traps going out in concentric circles around the area to try to determine what's the spread of the problem.
And it could be a problem because unlike our local mosquitoes, these ones can spread three exotic diseases: dengue fever, yellow fever, and chikungunya.
Those are generally the kinds of things that people pick up on their travels to more tropical type destinations. And if should they come back infected and then perhaps expose themselves to the local mosquitoes while they're actively infectious and sick, then there is that possibility that those mosquitoes could pick up the infection and then move it to somebody in the neighborhood who perhaps hadn't gone anywhere.
Currently, that's not really much of a concern, since the mosquito would have to be very widespread to make that a possibility. But in the meantime, Conlon could use your help keeping an eye out for these unwelcome visitors.
Mosquitoes get into people's homes all the time. That's not unusual. But if people are sitting there in their homes during broad daylight and they have mosquitoes buzzing around their face trying to bite them, that's not a good sign, and it's a pretty strong indication that it may be one of these two invasive species. And so we would appreciate getting a call in that particular case.
In the County News Center, I'm Dominic Fulgoni.
The first debate among Democratic presidential candidates will take place on Tuesday, October 13th, moderated by CNN anchorman Anderson Cooper, with additional questions to be posed by other CNN correspondents. The debate could include as many as six candidates. In addition to the frontrunners, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Senator Bernie Sanders. CNN has indicated that Vice President Joe Biden will be included if he declares his intent to run even as late as the day of the debate. Other Democrats invited to participate are former Massachusetts Governor Martin O'Malley, former Rhode Island Governor Lincoln Chafee, and former Virginian Senator Jim Webb, all considered long shots based on the poll results, averaging just over 1% each. The debate, hosted by CNN and Facebook, will be held in Las Vegas and is set to air on 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Tasha Matthews.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, East County Magazine.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Rebecca Williamson.
And Leon Thompson, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
This week's Destination East County includes a production of Stage Fright, a Craft and Harvest Festival, Oktoberfest, Fall Fest at Grossmont Center, and a Fair Trade Gift Fair.
Plus, we'll have a preview of coming attractions, including the Enchanted Garden Gala, an international jousting tournament, Haunt Fest on Main Street, and a trick-or-treat dog show.
Cajon Classic Cruise continues through October 28th in downtown El Cajon and features an amazing array of cars and different themes each Wednesday from 5 to 8 p.m. with free admission. October 14th will be El Cajon Speed Week, followed by the Best of the Best, October 21st and October 28th. The season ends with a trunk or treat. For details, see cajonclassiccruise.org.
Alpine Country Gifts and Crafts is hosting its 22nd annual Something to Crow About Crafts and Harvest Festival, October 9th, 10th, and 11th. The event features crafts and homemade items, including owl nesting boxes at the Alpine Women's Club on Alpine Boulevard. The hours will be 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. For more information, call 619-445-4212.
Lamplighters Community Theater in La Mesa continues its season with a mystery. Stage Fright opens on October 9th and runs through November 8th. This eerie tale focuses on a drama critique who is led by an attractive production assistant into a recently discovered 19th century theater. There, he is filmed an interview for a documentary on actor John Wilkes Booth, who once acted on these very boards. But when the critique, notorious for its venomous reviews, downs a glass of drugged wine, he awakens to find himself tied to a Shakespearean throne on a stage of the old theater. Besides an actress, he has Savage in reviews, who's plotted murderous revenge. For tickets and details, you can visit lamplightersamesa.com.
The Alpine Veterans of Foreign Wars will host a fall deep pit barbecue in Alpine this Saturday, October 10th, starting at 2 p.m. The menu includes beef, pork, and turkey with all the fixings. The event includes live music entertainment by Good Mojo Band from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. and a live auction. Tickets are on sale at the Post at 844 Tavern Road in Alpine. Children under 6 are free.
La Mesa Fire Station 11 on Allison Avenue, next door to the library, will hold an open house for Fire Prevention Week on Saturday, October 10th, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. This is a free event to educate the community and meet and greet the Heartland Fire and Rescue Firefighters. The event includes disaster preparedness information and the fire station tours and more.
The German American Societies of San Diego is hosting its traditional Oktoberfest, which began last weekend and continues this weekend, October 9th through 11th in El Cajon. This family-friendly festival promotes traditional German culture, including entertainment provided by a German band, plus folk dances, games, contests, vendors and craft stands, and a kids' fun zone. On Saturday nights, the clubhouse is open for dancing from 8 p.m. to midnight with live German music. You can also taste authentic German food such as bratwurst, ox on the spit, potato salad and potato pancakes, sauerkraut and red cabbage, plus a variety of German pastries and pretzels, and of course, German beer. There will be prize drawings, including a trip for two to Germany. This annual celebration takes place at the German American Society's headquarters on South Mollison Avenue in El Cajon. Free shuttle service is available from the El Cajon Transit Center. For more information, visit OktoberfestElCajon.com.
A fair trade gift fair will be held in La Mesa at St. Martin's of Tours Parish Hall on Sunday, October 11th from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. This free fair will offer handcrafted baskets, jewelry, clothing accessories, chocolate, coffee, tea, and more. Fair trade certification means artisans and farmers in the poorest areas of the world receive fair, livable wages for their products or ingredients, offering the public socially responsible shopping. In addition, production standards must protect the environment, build economic sustainability, provide opportunities for education and healthcare for families, and protect young children from forced labor. For more information, you can visit lamesafairtrade.blogspot.com.
Now for a preview of coming attractions. Grossmont College is hosting a free Latino film festival that explores Latino culture and history. The final film showing, También la Lluvi, inspired by the real-life water wars in Bolivia, will be shown on Tuesday, October 13th. The film starts at 6 p.m. at Grossmont College in El Cajon, in Building 26, Room 220.
Aztec dancers will perform in full costume at the main quad on Grossmont College on October 15th at 11 a.m. The dancers will explain the significance of their performance as it relates to the indigenous people who once dominated large parts of Mesoamerica from the 14th to the 16th centuries.
The San Diego East County Chamber of Commerce annual Women in Leadership Luncheon will observe its 13th year at the Town and Country Hotel in Mission Valley. The luncheon honors San Diego County women recognized by their peers as exemplary leaders. Women will be honored in seven fields: arts, media, culture, business, education, academia, hospitality, government, defense, healthcare, and nonprofit sector. This year's nominees include our very own East County Magazine editor, Miriam Raftery. Nominees must be San Diego County residents and have demonstrated exemplary character, integrity, and outstanding leadership, not only in their field, but in their community. You can visit eastcountychamber.org for more information and to purchase tickets for the Leadership Luncheon.
La Mesa's Chamber of Commerce will present Fall Fest, a new festival to be held on October 16th and 17th at Grossmont Center in La Mesa. This event features country rock and roll music, musical artists including Brent Payne, winner of the Best Country Song of the Year Award at the Hollywood Music Awards in 2012 for his best hit, Now Forever. He's nominated again this year for his song Midnight Prayer. A beer garden, food, and more are also part of fall festivities at this event. For more information on Fall Fest, visit lamesachamber.net.
A free concert at Mission Trails Regional Park on Sunday, October 18th at 3 p.m. will feature Yale Strom, an artist in residence at San Diego State University in the Jewish Studies program. a skilled violinist who also has a band called Hot Pastrami, in which he is accompanied by an accordion player. His primary focus is klezmer, Jewish music, and Roma, gypsy music. In addition to performing, Strom enjoys teaching his audience about the history and development of klezmer and Roma music. Mission Trails Regional Park Visitor Center is located at 1 Friar Junipero Cerro Trail in San Diego. For more information, visit mtrp.org.
The Water Conservation Garden at Cuyamaca College will once again be transformed into the Enchanted Garden during a gala event on October 17th. Wander a magical path through illuminated gardens as you enjoy ethereal music, delicious garden-inspired fare, and captivating entertainment. This year's theme is Water, More Precious Than Gold. The event includes a silent auction, seated outdoor dinner, and live program. Proceeds will support the garden's award-winning youth education program, as well as programs and services educating residents of all ages about conserving our most precious natural resource, water. The Water Conservation Garden is on the campus of Cuyamaca College in Rancho San Diego. For more information, go to thegarden.org/gala.
An international jousting competition, lifestyle camps from Rome to the Renaissance, and squire's equestrian skills are all part of the colorful lineup at the Tournament of the Phoenix and Festival of History. This event takes place Saturday, October 17th from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Poway Rodeo Grounds in Poway. The event also features live music, food, demonstrations and displays, exhibitors, shopping, games, and activities. For more information or tickets, visit tournamentofthephoenix.com.
The 50th annual Borrego Days Desert Festival will be held October 23rd through the 25th. This year's theme is Those Were the Days. Borrego Days Desert Festival has a long history of welcoming in the desert's peak season, enticing locals to come together after a long hot summer and to welcome snowbirds back for a warm desert winter. On Saturday, festival goers will line the main street for a popular parade that includes a flyover, equestrians, marching bands, floats, clowns, dancers, and more. There will also be live entertainment, arts and crafts, food vendors, children's activities, a beer and beverage garden, carnival fun zone, and inflatable water slides, obstacle course, bull ride, and more. For more details, you can visit borregodays.com.
Get your costume ready for the 4th annual Haunt Fest on Main in downtown El Cajon on October 23rd from 5 until 10 p.m. Admission is free, but some rides will charge a nominal fee. This fun, family-friendly Halloween-themed event features live bands, a haunted car show, a variety of local vendors, and food available for purchase. Visit the special children's craft and game booths, face painting, outdoor movies, and enjoy carnival rides. You can also dress in your favorite costume and enter the costume contest for a chance to win prizes. For more information, check out hauntfest.org.
The Alpine Stagecoach Lions Club is holding a trick-or-treat dog show on Saturday, October 24th at Summers Pass Farm in Flint Springs. The dog show runs from 1 to 4 p.m. with the costume contest, prizes, trophies, food, and fun. Plus, you can visit the pumpkin patch to pick your jack-o'-lantern. All proceeds from this event go directly to purchase a seeing eye service dog for someone in need. For details, see alpinelions.org.
That's all for this week. You can find details on all these events and more on our calendar and in our festivals and events sections online at eastcountymagazine.org.
Plus, if you have an event you'd like to add to our calendar, or if you'd like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, East County Magazine.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today, we're going to be talking about a new law that Governor Jerry Brown has just signed into law, the Right to Die Bill, very controversial piece of legislation. And our very special guest today, Wendy Patrick. Wendy is a PhD. She's a business ethics lecturer at San Diego State University, and she is also an attorney. Wendy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And we also have Leon Thompson here, who, of course, you know, is one of our hosts on the show. And Leon is here because he's been addressing this issue in his very family, and so we thought it would be important to get the perspective of a family member of a patient who is going through this potential horrible end-of-life decision to make. So, Wendy, can you start by telling us exactly what the law covers?
Well, Miriam, it's a very controversial law. You know, there's only a couple of states in the nation, with now California being one of them. That brings us to five, that allows basically the right to die. It's assisted suicide. Very controversial. There are such strong opponents on either side. People have been debating this issue for years across the nation. What it does is exactly that. It allows doctors to prescribe life-ending drugs. However, California's law actually provides some protections that are not provided by all of the states that allow this type of thing. So it's called the Right to Die Bill, is what most people call it.
Now, who is eligible for that? Is it anybody who wants to end their life? Is it people that are in chronic pain? Do you have to have a terminal condition? What safeguards are in there to prevent just anybody who's depressed from deciding that they want to commit suicide with a doctor's help?
And that's a great question, Miriam. I'm glad you asked that, because a lot of people are asking that exact question. Well, can anybody get it? Can you get it if you don't feel good, if you're in chronic pain, on and on? This law in California has a number of safeguards built into the law. I'll give you a couple examples. It only applies, first of all, to patients that are mentally sound. In other words, this has got to be an informed decision. It does not apply to people who are depressed. It does not apply to people who are mentally impaired. And it includes a number of requirements. First of all, the patient has to be physically capable of taking the medication themselves. Nobody can administer it for them, which many believe will cut down on a number of potential abuses. Two doctors have to approve it. This is a drug for terminally ill people with 6 or less months to live. Patients have to also submit several written requests. And there's even a requirement that there be a number of witnesses.
So you can't make a spur-of-the-minute decision.
Absolutely not. It cannot be a spur-of-the-minute decision. There has to be two witnesses, one of whom is not a family member. So there are a lot of safeguards built in, because as you can imagine, there are many that fear that a law like this is subject to abuse.
Sure. I would think some of the concerns might be perhaps a relative pressuring somebody into this because they don't want to care for them anymore. They want to inherit their money or something like that.
Isn't it terrible that we have to acknowledge that those risks come with this kind of a law? Those are absolutely some of the risks. And you also, like you mentioned earlier, this cannot be a decision in the spur of the moment based on a level of pain or a mental lapse or maybe a prescription drug induced sort of state of mental incompetence. You know, we've all seen people that go in and out of really battling terrible, terrible terminal illnesses.
Right.
But even in the throes of something like that, a patient must meet all of these requirements in order to qualify for one of these lethal overdose prescriptions.
Yeah. I imagine it raises a lot of ethical questions for the medical profession as well. What if somebody is a doctor who does not believe in this, who does not want to prescribe lethal doses? Maybe they have a religious objection. Do they have to?
I mean, doctors can prescribe or not prescribe, see patients, not see patients. In other words, this is not to the level of something that we are going to worry about doctors being put in position of, well, you're going to have to prescribe these drugs. This is something that is actually not intended to apply to most terminally ill patients. Most people don't want to die. They want to live. And there's just too many cases of patients that have seen some measure of improvement, even in the throes of battling very painful, serious illnesses. They want to live for their kids, their grandkids. So this is not something where people expect everybody's going to go out and try to obtain these prescriptions. Doctors do not expect to be put in the position of all of their terminal patients asking for this. One of the things that Governor Jerry Brown said also is very important. He really mentions and describes and discusses this as an option. In other words, there are people that obtain these drugs but don't use them. And wouldn't we want wish that on everybody? Anybody who actually feels bad enough to even go down this route, ultimately, we hope that they don't end their own lives.
That's interesting. Jerry Brown really wrestled with this morally. He, of course, is a Jesuit, was formerly in the Jesuit seminary. And so certainly there would be some religious concerns there. And yet he found himself wondering if he were ever in that position himself, would he want to have that option? And he said he certainly didn't want to deny that option to somebody else based on, you know, anybody's specific religious viewpoints.
He did. And he described his Catholic upbringing. He described all of the things that you mentioned. And, you know, the one of the strongest objections is a religious objection, that God decides when we die naturally, that we are not supposed to play God and decide when we are going to die. That has been one, continues to be one of the strongest objections to this kind of law. And that will continue to be an objection to this type of law being enforced. I mean, there's already been challenges filed. You'll see more, I would imagine, as with any legislation that is this controversial.
Sure.
And interestingly, also, Jerry Brown discussed that one of the reasons that brought him to actually agree to sign this law is, as you mentioned, he was really swayed by some of the arguments made by the patients for whom the passage of this bill was quite literally a matter of life and death.
Yes. I myself find that I have mixed emotions about it. I've been through this in my own family with own friends. My father died of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease, and he suffered terribly at the end. He was in a rest home. He was no longer able to feed himself, to see, you know, to hear, and he basically starved to death. I mean, it was a horrible thing. We didn't want to put a feeding tube into him, and it was just an awful thing to see. And I kept asking myself, why in a society where when we have a pet that can no longer eat or walk, we take it to the vet, they give them a shot. You know, I've held my dog, a cat, when they had a terminal condition like that. And in 30 seconds, they're gone. They just close their eyes. It's very peaceful. And they just don't wake up. And there's no suffering. And I don't know why we can do that for pets and not for people. And yet, on the other hand, I think about a friend of mine where our children were born the same day, our babies, and she found out a month later that she had a brain tumor. They told her it was terminal, fast growing, and that she would be dead in a month. And she was partly paralyzed on one side of her body, having blinding headaches. And yet, she kept doing her research, or her husband did, and they found some experimental treatment, and it worked. And she went into complete remission. The tumor went away. And she lived another 13 years before she missed a checkup, and it finally came back. But it really made the difference between her son growing up knowing his mother or not. And I thought, what if this option had been available, and when she was having a lot of pain, if she had taken that option, you know? So you really wrestle with it a little bit of when it's right and when it's wrong. Leon, I know that you're going through a situation in your own family, and I was wondering, how is this impacting you and the family member that has the condition? I understand that there have been some conversations about the issue.
Yeah, we just talked about this a few days ago. My sister, who was diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer, which had spread to her liver and bones in her back and her brain.
Terrible.
So she was facing years, perhaps, of chemo. They were recommending 31 rounds of radiation and 12 rounds of...
Wow.
Now, I've been through this with my wife, who died in 2009. Yeah, that was... she'd gone through all of that, and it came back. It was a metastatic breast cancer that had gone to every organ in her abdomen. Essentially.
I remember she was in so much pain and in hospice at the end, and right, how heart-wrenching that was to see you and her going through that.
Well, my sister knows about that as well, and The way we were looking at it is a balance between the quality of life the last few years, when your days are numbered, and
do your bucket list. And
well, yeah, and I think my sister asked me, would Susie have maybe chosen to forego all of the chemo and just die naturally, I suppose you'd say, if that were a better quality of life for 3 years rather than a miserable 5 years, which would she choose? So it was a matter of choosing between a quality of life, perhaps, you know, or always being sick, going through all these procedures. But I think that the trump card, at least with my sister, was that there was just too many people who needed her and loved her and, you know, couldn't live without her. And there's always a chance that the treatment could work.
Yeah.
It doesn't always work, but sometimes it does.
That's true.
Sometimes these things go into remission on their own. You don't think they will.
Yeah, and you know, we don't put people down like we put dogs down. And that's the counter-argument, is that human beings are made in the image of God. We are very different than pets. As much as we love our pets and they, you know, we love them like our children, we always make the joke that sometimes they're part of the family. But there's a big difference. These are the two sides of the argument. To say, well, we're going to put a human being down before God has decided the person's going to die a natural death is very hard to wrap your mind around. Mm-hmm. Yet, you're right, that is the argument. This is the compassionate argument. It's the dying with dignity. But it's still impossible to reconcile that with the religious objections. You just can't marry the two. Very different.
Although certainly someone with a religious objection can choose not to do that, to go through that suffering, and if that's their choice.
But it's more than that. It's they don't want that to be the option for anybody because they believe so you know, the value of human life is so strong that even if they themselves never get sick, they don't want to give people, as Governor Brown calls it, that option, because people are going to exercise that option.
Some certainly will.
Some will.
I know even Leanne had mentioned that his sister, when she heard about the law, mentioned that she took some comfort in the fact that if things got bad enough, she'd have a place that she could go to.
But Miriam, your story about your friend recovering after and living another 13 years, you know, I hope listeners consider the fact that people do recover. They're given an amount of time to live, and 5 years, 10 years later, they're still here. Sometimes they've improved, and medical procedures improve all of the time. So there's hope.
That's very true. You know, something that might have been terminal 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 1 year ago,
certainly isn't.
There's stem cell, you know, another example. I have an uncle who died of bone cancer, and it's a very painful condition. And at the time, there was no cure and really no treatment for it back then. And my mother's neighbor, who's quite elderly, had the same condition. I was all prepared for, gosh, they're going to lose him. And he got a stem cell treatment that's new, and he is doing great. He's back to flying his airplane again.
Oh, that's a wonderful story.
You know. So I know my personal advice has always been to friends going through difficult times. I have a couple of them right now going through potentially life-threatening conditions, is hang in there, because you don't know what they say is a terminal diagnosis right now. A year from now, they might have a cure for it. So if you can stand it, you know, to hang in there, do it.
Amen to that. And I like the way you added, if you can stand it, because that's the other side of the coin, is people with these conditions argue that the quality of life is just so low. Yet can it ever be low enough that we're going to allow this kind of a law? Five states now say yes. And we've talked about the word option. If you look at the statistics, hundreds of people are availing themselves of this option.
I was wondering, how do they have any statistics in the states that have legalized this?
They do, and they've kept track of this. And it's not just an option. It's an option that's being exercised. People are going through the process of dying with dignity, as they would argue, and the rest of the community. And it's not just the religious community. There are ethical issues legally, medically, and religious ethics. There are lots of people that believe all sorts of things that don't believe that we should be taking our own lives before it's time. They don't believe in any kind of assisted suicide.
Now, we took a look at Oregon, which has had a right to life law on the books for 13 years. And in those 13 years, it's averaged about 100 people a year who actually took their lives.
through the assisted suicide law. It's interesting that year after year, about a third of them who are prescribed do not take it. And of those who do, almost all of them had cancer and most of them were elderly.
What are some of the legal questions?
Well, legally, obviously, we don't want to have to give the power to kill somebody else, even in the name of compassion or with a compassionate way to end life is what they're really calling it, a way to die with dignity. That's the argument. That's one of the legal arguments. And then you've got to look at all of the different things that go along with that. I'll make the analogy to the lethal injection method of execution. There are, and always will be, I would imagine, lots of arguments surrounding how do you kill somebody who's been sentenced to the death penalty. There's an analogy here, as you can imagine. How do you know? You know, you gave the example, Marion, of your pet dying. How do you know what anybody suffers when they are, and they're not around to tell you what it was like? So that's one of the arguments. Then you've also got arguments regarding, well, what kind of doctors and what are their qualifications? Who gets to decide that somebody has 6 months to live? Go back to your example of somebody being told that, living another 13 years. So yeah. There's going to be a competence issue as to, well, maybe I should have gotten a second, third, fourth opinion. What kind of witnesses? You can see all the levels of potential arguments that go into the mix in deciding who qualifies.
Well, and then there's the whole insurance issue. Might there be people who feel pushed into doing this because they don't want to bankrupt their family on, you know, humongous medical bills that maybe their insurance isn't covering for?
Or they don't want to be a burden on their family, exactly as you say, whether it's financially, emotionally. You know, we could go on forever thinking of issues, potential issues that surround this very important decision, whether to take a pill that's going to kill you. And the fact that that's legal now in 5 states. And I got to mention the fact that there is no denying that California is a trendsetter. So there are lots of people around the country who looked at yesterday's decision by Governor Brown thinking, well, since California is such a trendsetter, we would imagine other states attempting to push through similar legislation. And that's a scary thought to all of the objectors that don't like the fact that even 5 states so far have this law. And again, you can imagine that's going to be even more litigation on both sides of the issue to try to see where this ends up.
Is suicide illegal?
Assisted suicide is illegal. But in all of the states except for 5, assisting somebody. Remember Dr. Jack Kevorkian?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I mean, that's an example of someone who was continually prosecuted, and it took a number of trials to get a conviction there every time he took the stand and said, I did it.
So basically now Dr. Kevorkian wouldn't be convicted today.
Not if he was in one of these 5 states.
Well, or if he was dealing with only terminal patients.
Well, again, the law has been, in all of the rest of the states, you know, assisted suicide has been on the books as against the law. It's been on the books as a crime. That is why this decision is such a landmark decision. It is so controversial, and it's certainly not the majority opinion in many of the states. We'll probably revisit this a decade from now and see what direction we've gone, that this should be something that doctors are allowed to.
Have we seen litigation challenging this yet? Have we seen anybody saying somebody died who didn't really want to, where they were pushed into it by somebody else? You know, and I'm also curious, a certain number of very ill people, terminally ill people, certainly find ways to take their own life anyway. It might be by a gunshot or hanging themselves or saving up the pills, you know. I'm curious whether the number of those kind of tragic cases may go down if there's an easier, a little bit more humane way for somebody who's determined to end their life when they're ill. Those are stats I, as a journalist, would like to see.
Yeah, I can imagine if you sought to find those statistics, you would find far more than you wanted to find, and then you'd be left wondering, what are the legitimate statistics? How many people that died of overdose was intentional? You can't really know when looking in retrospect, and that's why these things are so tricky, is it's such a terrible topic that we have to discuss and that we have to address. I mean, it's one of those topics that we wish never came up. We never wish anybody to be in pain or even consider taking too much of medication. What we don't know is when it's an accident. And one of the reasons that we all know this is how many people have we known that can hardly wait the amount of time you're supposed to wait before their pills that are providing some measure of relief to a terminal condition. And you wonder about accidental overdose. You wonder about somebody's state of mind. There's just so many unanswered questions. And you ask a great one here. How do we know how many people voluntarily overdose on prescribed medication
already?
Already.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think that not having the law means that you don't have anybody terminal who's killing themselves. It's very easy to say we should wait, we should let nature take its course until you're the one in unbearable pain.
I know. So you're the one in their shoes.
Exactly. Yeah. It's very easy to say what somebody else should do. But when it's you and you're the one with unbearable pain and a terminal diagnosis, I really want to make that decision for somebody else. We want someone else making that decision. If it was me, if it was you, or do you want to have the right to make your own decision?
Yeah.
So that's really what the law is about.
We haven't walked in their shoes, have we?
No, we haven't.
Well, like that's the counter argument that, and I, you know, I was talking about this with somebody yesterday, is they would say, be in my body for 1 hour and then you tell me what you think about this law.
Yeah.
That would be the counter argument.
Yeah.
Is look at the three of us sitting here healthy, enjoying life.
Just in a catastrophic car accident. So it was a little easier for me to understand it.
Yeah.
I think, what if I was never going to get better? What if I was always going to feel this way and it was only going to get worse?
Yeah. You know? I hope we continue to see improvements in the medical community. I hope we continue to come up with drugs that lessen the burden at the end of life. I mean, the hope in all of this is perhaps laws being passed like this will only make all of us collectively work harder to find living solutions, hopeful solutions, ways to cure these incurable diseases, to bring some compassionate relief to these patients instead of killing them.
Yeah, well, that's certainly the hope. I think that's a positive note to end.
Let's all go out and donate to medical research tonight. Let's do what we can to help the living.
Yeah, let's fund that research so that we can hopefully find cures for some of the things that they can't cure right now. Mm-hmm. And if people want to know more about the legislation, the new law, I should say, is there a source that they can go to read more about it or to read perhaps?
The source is the internet. We live in a day and age where it's not difficult to find information that you need. You can look at the California legislation website. You can look at different states that keep these statistics. You can look at different groups, some of which advocate for and against laws like this. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is so easy to find answers nowadays to any questions that you need. There's no more secret to finding information. And I would encourage anybody who's curious, interested, or God forbid touched by this kind of a scenario to do all the research you can before making this kind of a decision. Talk to everybody you need to talk to before making this kind of a decision. Even if you never exercise the option, it's worth knowing all of the different options that are out there.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. And we're certainly going to be posting a story about this on eastcountymagazine.org. And we will have a link to the bill and the signing statement and so forth as well for those who want to learn more about it. I want to thank you very much for joining us here today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you for having me.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, East County Magazine.
Bolt tires are being blamed for a collision in which a Mercedes-Benz sedan struck a county van that was transporting five senior citizens for the Ramona Senior Center. The Ramona Sentinel reports that a 19-year-old woman from Ramona was driving the Mercedes when she lost traction on a rain-slicked highway on Vista Ramona. She crossed into another lane and struck the left front of the van and then spun around and struck the rear of the van. California Highway Patrol Officer Jeff Christie said the tires on the Mercedes were completely bald and urged motorists to get their tires inspected with a wet winter due to El Nino conditions. Both drivers were transported to area hospitals with head pain and other injuries. Passengers in the van, including a 99-year-old, were treated for injuries and transferred to another vehicle, according to CAL FIRE. Fortunately, all were wearing seatbelts. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is DeVario Bell.
This is Bill Driscoll with a health report from East County Magazine on KNSJ. Senate Bill 287, the Sudden Cardiac Arrest Safety Act, has been signed into law by Governor Jerry Brown. The bill was authorized by State Senator Ben Hueso, a Democrat representing San Diego and the southern portions of East County. The new law will require that buildings constructed after January 2017 with an occupancy of 200 or more must install an automated external defibrillator or AED on site. AEDs can diagnose life-threatening cardiac arrest and treat a heart attack, restoring the heart's normal rhythm. Current law requires AEDs only in fitness centers or gyms. The new law will dramatically expand the availability of AEDs, increasing survival rates after heart attacks across California, Senator Hueso says. He also says time matters. For every minute following a sudden cardiac arrest without defibrillation from an AED, an individual's chance of survival decreases by 10%. The immediate use of an AED can drastically increase the survival rate by 70%. An estimated 350,000 people in the United States suffer sudden cardiac arrest each year. Of those, over 52,000 die from sudden cardiac arrest at the workplace, public parks, commercial buildings, streets, highways, or transit centers. According to the Sudden Cardiac Arrest Foundation, the number of people who die from sudden cardiac arrest is equivalent to the number of people who die from Alzheimer's disease, assault with firearms, breast cancer, cervical cancer, colorectal cancer, diabetes, HIV, house fires, motor vehicle accidents, prostate cancer, and suicides combined. SB 287 was inspired by a similar measure passed by the San Diego City Council back in 2008.
This is Marilyn Lyons from East County Magazine with some important news on wildfire safety. As San Diego County enters the perilous fall wildfire season, you can now tap into a new online map to learn the level of fire risk in your immediate area and resources for finding help in an emergency. This digital tool allows San Diegans to search the county by address or place name in order to learn the degree of wildfire hazard and how to better prepare for an emergency. Many of the county's biggest blazes have struck this fall, fed by Santa Ana winds and tinderbox conditions in the backcountry. Supervisor Diane Jacob says wildfire is a year-round threat in our region, but fall can be especially brutal. The online map is an eye-opening reminder of the risks we face, but it also provides critical information on fire protection and preparedness. A link to the new wildfire hazard map can be found at www.readysandiego.org. It draws on existing data collected by California fire officials to assess conditions on properties statewide. The map shows large areas of the county, mostly in the backcountry, are high to very high hazard zones as defined by state officials. Other areas fall into moderate category or are not considered a serious risk. When an address or place name is entered, the map provides the hazard designation along with related links and information, including the names of the fire protection agency for that location, the closest fire station, and a detailed guide to fire preparedness. Many addresses also provide contact information for the local Fire Safe Council, a network of nonprofits that promote fire safety and preparedness. The map is available on both desktop and mobile devices.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Kevin McLeod. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.